I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. On December 4th in Riverside, California, the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies held a seminar on the biopolitics of popular culture. It was aimed at examining the ways that images of non-humans and the future and emerging technologies in popular culture, specifically science fiction, fantasy, and horror, shapes our understanding of our future technologies and the future of humanity. One of the papers that was delivered there was by Jess Nevins, and it was titled, "Those Who Cannot Remember Doc Savage Are Condemned to Repeat Him, the 20th Century Backlash Against Post-Human Bodybuilders." Jess Nevins is a reference librarian at the University of California at Riverside and author of Heroes and Monsters, the unofficial companion to the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, the Encyclopedia of Fantastic Victoriana, and the Encyclopedia of Pulp Heroes, forthcoming in 2010.
The following is not intended as a prediction, but it can be taken as a cautionary tale about what might happen when we finally achieve technology that can produce superhumans, transhumans, and posthumans. A backlash and a Foucauldian regulation of the concepts of the superhuman and the posthuman through the public discourse of popular fiction. It happened once before. A recurring concern in Great Britain during the 19th century was the physical state of the average British soldier. After the end of the Napoleonic Wars, British Army leadership decided that British soldiers needed more than just formal drills and team sports to get into shape. The British government decided to imitate the athletic and gymnastic movements of Western Europe, which emphasized repeated exercise on the forerunners of the modern balance beam, horizontal bar, parallel bar, and vaulting horse. But despite changes to the exercise regimens of the British public, military, and schoolboys, no progress was made. And during the Crimean War of the 1850s, British soldiers were once again viewed as physically inferior. In the aftermath of the war, two separate social movements arose. The first was muscular Christianity, whose proponents believed not only in mens sana in corpore sano, a sound mind and a sound body, but that it was a Christian's duty to build and maintain a sound, healthy body. More broadly, muscular Christianity was a rebuke to the idea of physical weakness and effeminacy being identified with spiritual strength. The second social movement, contemporary with and complementary to muscular Christianity, was New Athleticism, which attempted to use sports to instill character, manliness, and modesty, create teamwork, and bridge class differences. New Athleticism spawned numerous organizations and social groups who propagandized for the virtues of cricket, football, and rugby, as well as more general exercise. Both muscular Christianity and New Athleticism were touted as the solutions for what was seen as the degenerate state of the British working class's body. For many Britons, the body of the British soldier was the representation and even reification of racial fitness in idealized masculinity, and most British soldiers came from the working classes. But many Britons during the 1860s and 1870s became convinced that the average British soldier was weaker than his predecessors. Fears that the empire was in decline were commonplace. Increasing numbers of men were found to be physically invalid for military service, and it was commonly believed that the infant mortality rate was skyrocketing. Most Britons believed that the British race was decaying and in danger of becoming decadent. These ideas gained power in the 1880s and 1890s and became convictions deeply held by many in the thinking and policy-making classes. A response to these ideas was the physical culture movement, that's with capital P, capital C, which began in the 1880s. Physical culture emphasized cultivating the self in mind and body, both to become a better Christian and to reverse the trend toward racial decay. Recommended methods for these goals were regular exercise, vegetarianism, sunbathing, nude air bathing, temperance, and personal cleanliness. The physical culture movement was directly influenced by muscular Christianity and New Athleticism, but both muscular Christianity and New Athleticism had promoted games and athletics as the ideal vehicles for instilling manliness. However, in Britain, games and athletics had traditionally been the province of the elite. The physical culture movement was aimed at men and, to a lesser degree, women of all social backgrounds, especially at the lower and working classes. And the movement de-emphasized games and instead promoted gymnastics, weightlifting, and other exercises, which had no competitive aspects and which required neither playing fields nor expensive equipment. The most famous advocate for the physical culture movement and the first globally famous bodybuilder was Eugene Sandow. The Prussian Sandow, born Friedrich Muller, ran away from home as a young man to join a traveling circus and used the gymnastics and the acrobatics he learned there to harden his body. After the circus went bankrupt, he became the student of a professional bodybuilder and honed and emphasized his musculature. He took the name Eugene Sandow and began touring Belgian and French music halls as a strongman and a living statue. In 1889, Sandow gained fame in London by interrupting the routine of two well-known professional strongmen, accepting their challenge and outlifting both. This led to fame, bookings across England, and a four-year tour of lifting, flexing, and posing. In 1893, Sandow traveled to the United States. During one performance, he caught the eye of promoter Florence Ziegfeld, who took charge of Sandow's career and brought him to Chicago, where Sandow became the headliner of the 1894 World's Fair. At this time, professional strongmen performed feats of strength that were as much artifice and deception as they were reality. But Sandow performed wearing only a very skimpy loincloth. Very skimpy loincloth. So that no deception was possible. And his combination of sex appeal and undeniably real acts of strength gained him numerous fans. Sandow went on a national tour and in 1894 made a four-minute kinetoscope film, Sandow the Modern Hercules, which is commonly available on YouTube today, in which he posed, flexed, and stretched, showing off his very well-developed musculature. The film played in vaudevilles and circuses and cemented Sandow's status as an icon of muscle and strength. In 1897, Sandow began what he thought of as his true mission, reforming the bodies of humanity. In London, he opened the Institute of Physical Culture, a gymnasium and center for teaching the average Briton new forms of diet and exercise so that everyone, not just Sandow, could look like Sandow and be capable of the same feats. The Institute was immediately successful. Other institutes opened, and in 2 years, fitness was a national craze in both the United States and Great Britain. At a time when British concerns about national racial degeneracy were reaching new heights, and when Americans were gripped with fears of Americanitis, racial neurasthenia, or nervous exhaustion peculiar to Americans, Sandow seemed to be offering a solution. In 1898, he founded Sandow's Magazine of Physical Culture, which combined articles on health and bodybuilding with fiction. Imitations of Sandow's magazine followed, but it was Sandow's magazine which remained the leader in the physical culture field. Sandow organized the world's first bodybuilding competition in the Royal Albert Hall in 1901, attended by thousands and judged by Sandow and Arthur Conan Doyle. He performed at a private audience for the German Crown Prince Friedrich Wilhelm. Sandow was the subject of a celebrity postcard by the Rotary Photographic Company, the leading celebrity postcard manufacturer of the era, and he became a marketing icon on par with Theodore Roosevelt and the explorer Henry Stanley of Dr. Livingston, I presume, fame, endorsing everything from Bovril, the fluid beef, to sporting goods. Sandow provided a model for other bodybuilder entrepreneurs to follow. In America, the leading strength performer was Bernard McFadden, who went on to found McFadden Publications, which produced numerous magazines and pulps up until 1992. McFadden was directly inspired to imitate Sandow after seeing him perform at the Chicago World's Fair. Zisha Breitbart, the Samson of Vienna, the most famous Jewish strongman ever, was directly inspired by Sandow. And Angelo Siciliano, better known as Charles Atlas, put a picture of Sandow on his bedroom mirror for inspiration.
The widespread imitation of Sandow is understandable. He was popular with all classes. He made a considerable amount of money from the physical culture movement. For all that he genuinely believed in physical culture, he was an aggressive entrepreneur. Sandow appeared as, quote, the finest example of the white race in the British Museum's 1901 Races of the World exhibit. And Sandow was hugely popular with women. For years, he performed at private strip shows for women, showing off his musculature. For years, he was touted as the icon of idealized masculinity. And it was widely known he was the biggest whore in professional bodybuilding. He slept with everything that moved. It's understandable that many bodybuilders tried to imitate him and even outdo him. During the 19th century, carnival strongmen routinely compared themselves to Hercules, Atlas, and other figures from Greek myth, and performed feats of supposedly superhuman strength. These feats were deceit and fraud, and this fraud was one of the things that the young Sandow had worked against. But with physical culture at its peak, strongmen began combining actual feats of strength with traditional circus trickery and advertised themselves as superhuman, using that word. And now we come to my relevance to this meeting. Advances in weightlifting technology, including organotherapy, thyroid grafting, thyroid extracts, and injected animal testicular matter, were touted as helping to create these superhumans. The rhetoric from Sandow, McFadden, and other physical culture proponents used phrases like perfect manhood and womanhood, idealized form of the human body, and peak of human development. Those attempting to surpass Sandow used rhetoric like first of a new breed of man, forerunner of the next stage of human development, a man of legendary, not human strength, a human being of supernatural powers, and simply superhuman. The association between bodybuilding and superhumanity was repeatedly made in popular fiction. Superhumans in popular fiction didn't begin with bodybuilding and Sandow, of course. Vigilantes with superhuman abilities appear throughout 19th century popular literature. The dime novel detectives Old Sleuth in 1872 and Old Cap Collier in 1883 are described as being able to throw grown men around like pillows and to be able to hold burly thugs above their heads with one hand. But the craze for physical culture led to a surge in bodybuilder superhumans in popular fiction. Sandow himself appeared as a character in dime novels as early as 1894, and in 1899, Sandow's magazine was regularly running fiction starring superhumanly strong bodybuilder characters. Other magazine publishers were quick to imitate Sandow's magazine and to capitalize on the popularity of Sandow and the physical culture movement by creating more superhuman bodybuilders. Sandow became part of the phenomenon in the first half of the 20th century, in which celebrities were used as characters and protagonists in adventure and mystery stories. Sandow was one of the first celebrities to be used in this way. In addition to being a major character, he also influenced other characters. The dime novel detective Nick Carter was, next to Sherlock Holmes, the iconic detective in global popular literature from 1890 to 1920. Carter, who debuted in 1886, a year before Sherlock Holmes, was described from the very first story he was in, as having superhuman strength. But in 1896, Carter is suddenly described as having been taught weightlifting and strength training by Eugene Sandow. Illustrations of Carter suddenly changed and portrayed him as a virtual double for Sandow. And in 1904, Sandow appeared in a Nick Carter story, using his superhuman strength to help Carter solve a murder. Up through the end of World War I, numerous characters of superhuman strength appeared in popular fiction who were either explicitly bodybuilders and physical culture devotees, or whose iconography and personality implicitly made them such to the reading audiences. The hero of the 1902 comic strip Hugo Hercules, for example, is capable of lifting elephants and stopping runaway carriages simply by grabbing them. He's never explicitly described as being a physical culture devotee, but every contemporary reader, seeing Hercules' dress and manner, knew where Hercules' strength came from. There were a variety of superhuman heroes in popular fiction during these years, but the bodybuilder superhuman was among the most common type. The physical culture craze faded, and its diet and weightlifting regimen became just another hobby. The Victorian worries about racial degeneracy gave way to a pre-World War I Edwardian self-satisfaction. Sandow and his imitators continued to prosper, but their audience contracted and eventually consisted of only committed hobbyists. a backlash against physical culture began, especially against its claims to produce superhumans. Even at its height, physical culture had had detractors. In 1905, Staff Surgeon A. Gaskell, in the British Statistical Report of the Health of the Navy for the year 1905, claimed that, and I quote, "the physically strong man, as trained by the original Sandow or other system, withstands the attacks of disease very badly. That the strong man who is the product of physical culture rarely reaches old age and is, in Gaskell's words, a giant with muscles of brass and, in a constitutional sense, feet of clay. The strong man is a whited sepulcher." In 1907, Herbert Forder, a former instructor at Sandow's school, turned on his former employer, describing the, quote, "utter worthlessness of Sandowism." And by the mid-1930s, official opinion of physical culture was almost universally negative, and American physical educators claimed that the physical culture movement as a whole was based on faulty conceptions of human nature. Sandow himself was not exempt from criticism. H.G. Wells parodied Sandow in The Marketing and Claims of Physical Cultures in Tono Bungay in 1909. Rumors spread during World War I that Sandow was a German spy, and in 1915, the San Francisco Chronicle claimed that he'd been executed in the London Tower by the British government for spying. The physical culture movement had been aimed at the working and middle classes, and the physical culture bodybuilders had advertised themselves as beings that any follower of physical culture could become. And the bodybuilder superhumans of popular fiction were often explicitly described as being ordinary people apart from their superhuman physical abilities. But the working and middle classes, the attended audience for physical culture's claims, eventually turned on the movement. A typical reaction appears in James Joyce's Ulysses, in which Leopold Bloom sees Sandow as the last hope for rejuvenation, but also feels intimidated by Sandow and by his own failure to live up to Sandow and his exercise regimen. After the enthusiasm for physical culture faded, the common reaction to the movement and to the prospect of potential superhumanity available to all was insecurity, depression over the inability to achieve it, envy toward those who had, and eventually dislike for the entire movement. Adding to this dislike was the embrace of physical culture by the nascent American and British fascist movements in the late 1920s and the early 1930s, and then by the Nazi Party in Germany in the mid-30s, and by physical culture's embrace of fascism. Interest in the physical culture movement surged again in the 1920s and 1930s after a renewal after World War I of the fears over the physical decline of the white race. But many in the physical culture movement saw fascism as the answer to this problem, just as many British, American, and German fascists celebrated the body beautiful and saw physical culture as the best way to achieve it. Many in physical culture reacted negatively to the fascists in the movement, but what the American and British public saw was the mutual admiration between physical culture and fascism. The backlash was slower to appear in popular fiction, but was more emphatic. From 1919 to 1954, roughly 75% of all superhumans in popular fiction outside of comic books either lost their powers, had them fade away without explanation, or got married and abandoned using their superhuman abilities. Doc Savage was the iconic, well, Doc Savage and the Shadow were the iconic heroes of the American pulps. Both had superhuman powers. Doc Savage began with his superhuman strength, and the Shadow, in his first in his radio incarnation and then in his pulp incarnation, had the ability to cloud men's minds so that they could not see him. The third most popular superhuman pulp character, now mostly forgotten, was the Avenger, who had the ability to rearrange the muscles in his face so that he could take on any other person's features. By the Avenger's last appearance in 1944, an operation has cured the facial paralysis, which gave him his superhuman ability. By Doc Savage's last appearance in 1949, he is simply a talented, strong human being, his superhuman strength having disappeared years before without explanation. By the Shadow's last appearance in 1954, his powers are gone and he's merely a standard private detective. I have dozens of examples, I'll just give you a few. In 1919, cowboy Dan Barry can talk to animals. In 1923, he's turned into a villain and is killed by his lover. In 1931, Philip Strange is the Brain Devil, an ESP-wielding pilot and agent of American Army Intelligence. By 1939, Strange's mental powers have faded away, and he's just another pulp-flying spy. In 1940, the Red Knight has super strength, invisibility, and mind control. In 1943, he loses his powers during a mission in Japan. In 1940, Scarlet O'Neill can turn invisible by pressing a nerve on her left wrist. By 1949, O'Neill is merely a fast-talking, crime-busting reporter, her invisibility long since forgotten. In 1939, the Black Bat can see in the dark thanks to an eye transplant. By 1953, he's had a second eye transplant and only has normal sight, and so on. Now, I excluded the superhero comics for a very simple reason. The economics of the superhero comic industry basically mandated that there would always be more superhuman superheroes, and that their powers wouldn't go away. But what happened in the superhero comics of the Golden Age, the late 1930s, early 1940s, is that the superheroes quickly went from stabs at relevance to a discrete fantastic world completely divorced from reality. Superman begins as a populist. He busts up corrupt bankers and munitions dealers. He is fighting for the common man against corporate governmental corruption. Within a couple of years, he is obviously an alien. He can fly. His home of origin, Krypton, is brought in. And there is very little similarity between the world of Superman and our reality. This can be seen over and over in the superheroes of the Golden Age. So the backlash, the regulation and backlash of the concept of the post-human, in outside of the comics, the regulation manifests itself by the stripping of powers or making them into not superhumans. In superhero comics, regulation manifested itself by divorcing them from our reality and making them purely fantastic. As I hope I've made clear, any hopes for a harmonious future of humans and post-humans should be carefully considered. Technology has changed, but human nature is not. Thank you.
You've been listening to a talk by Jess Nevins at the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies Biopolitics of Popular Culture Seminar, December 4th, 2009, in Riverside, California. Jess's talk was titled, "Those Who Cannot Remember Doc Savage Are Condemned to Repeat Him, the 20th Century Backlash Against Post-Human Bodybuilders." You can find more of the talks and video from that seminar at the IEET.org website. I'd like to read a little of a recent essay by Cory Doctorow. It was published at tinhousebooks.com and the blog there. And it's titled Radical Presentism. Cory, you probably know, is a very popular science fiction writer and one-time lobbyist for the Electronic Freedom Foundation. And he's been very engaged with issues of open source science and fighting back against intellectual property overreach. So this is his essay, Radical Presentism. Every writer has a FAQ, a frequently awkward question or two, and for me it's this one. How is it possible to work as a science fiction writer to predicting the future when everything is changing so quickly? Aren't you afraid that actual events will overtake the events that you've described? It's a freshly scrubbed, earnest kind of question, and the asker pays the compliment of casting you as a wise prognosticator in the bargain, but I think it's junk. Science fiction writers don't predict the future, except accidentally, but if they're very good, they may manage to predict the present. Mary Shelley wasn't worried about reanimated corpses stalking Europe, but by casting a technological innovation in the starring role of Frankenstein, she was able to tap into present-day fears about technology overpowering its masters and the hubris of the inventor. Orwell didn't worry about a future dominated by view screens from 1984. He worried about a present in which technology was changing the balance of power, creating opportunities for the state to enforce its power over individuals at ever more granular levels. Now, it's true that some writers will tell you that they're extrapolating a future based on rigor and science, but they're just wrong. Carol Capek coined the term robot to talk about the automation and dehumanization of the workplace. Asimov's robots were not supposed to be metaphors, but they sure acted like them, revealing the great writer's belief in a world where careful regulation could create positive outcomes for society. How else to explain his idea that all robots would comply with the three laws for thousands of years, or in the Foundation series, the existence of a secret society that knows exactly how to exert its leverage to steer the course of human civilization for millennia? For some years now, science fiction has been in the grips of a conceit called the singularity, the moment at which human and machine intelligence merge, creating a break with history beyond which the future cannot be predicted because the post-humans who live there will be utterly unrecognizable to us in their emotions and motivations. Read one way, it's a sober prediction of the curve of history spiking infinite-ward in the near future, and many futurists will solemnly assure you that this is the case. And read another way, it's just the anxiety of a generation of winners in the technology wars now confronted by a new generation whose fluidity with technology is so awe-inspiring that it appears we have been out-evolved by our own progeny. Science fiction writers who claim to be writing the future are more apt to be hamstrung by their timidity than by the pace of events. An old saw in science fiction is that a science fiction writer can take the automobile and the movie theater and predict the drive-in. But the drive-in is dead, and the echoes of its social consequences are fading to negligibility. On the other hand, the fact that the automobile was responsible for the first form of widely carried photo ID, and is thus the progenitor of the entire surveillance state, went unremarked upon by predictive science fiction. Some of my favorite contemporary speculative fiction is instead nakedly allegorical in its approach to the future, or the past, as the case may be. Consider Bruce Sterling's The Caryatids, an environmental techno-thriller. Sterling once defined a techno-thriller as a science fiction novel with the president in it. Set in a mid-21st century in which global warming has done its catastrophic best to end humanity. Finally forced to confront the reality of anthropogenic climate change, humanity fizzles and factions into three warring camps: the Dispensation, an Algorian green capitalist technocracy; the Aquis, libertarian technocrats who will beta test anything, preferably on themselves; and China, a technocracy based on the idea that technology can make command and control systems actually work, in contrast to the gigantic market failure that destroyed the planet. The play of these three ideologies serves as a brilliant and insightful critique of the contemporary approach to environmental remediation. Sterling especially gets the way that technology is a disruptor, that it unmakes the status quo over and over again, and that a battle of technologies is a battle in which the sands never stop shifting. Casting his tale into the future allows him to illustrate just how uneven our footing is in the present day. And the fact that the book consists of humans getting by, even getting ahead, despite all the chaos and devastation, makes The Caryatids one of the most optimistic books I've read in recent days. Moving back in time, there's William Gibson's Spook Country, a science fiction novel so futuristic that Gibson set it in a year before it was published. This was a ballsy genius move, which Gibson characterized as speculative presentism, a novel that uses the tricks of science fiction in a contemporary setting, telling a story that revolves around technology and its effect on people. Gibson's protagonist is Hollis Henry, a washed-up pop star who is writing for an art magazine published by a sinister, gigantic PR firm. An assignment brings her into the orbit of a set of post-national spies fighting an obscure and vicious battle with motivations that are baffling and eventually wonderful. Contrasting spycraft, technological art, and the weird hybrid semi-governmental firm that is characteristic of the 21st century, this book makes you feel like you are indeed living in the future right here in the present. Science fiction is a literature that uses the device of futurism to show up the present, a time that is difficult enough to get a handle on. As the pace of technological change accelerates, the job of the science fiction writer becomes not harder but easier and more necessary. After all, the more confused we are by our contemporary technology, the more opportunities there are to tell stories that lessen that confusion. This was an essay by Cory Doctorow called Radical Presentism. It was published in tinhousebooks.com and their blog there. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.